Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're going to be continuing the life of David today. We're going to be dealing with the rebellion of Absalom and how it was finally stopped. To get the idea of what's going to happen, you need to look at the set of maps. Hopefully your study Bible has a set of maps in the back. If you'll turn to those set of maps, I'm going to be looking at the map that deals with the kingdom of David. So let's look together. David had left Jerusalem, which is right over here, okay, and gone to Jericho, crossed over Jordan, and gone way back up here in the territory of Gad, right on the border of Manasseh. It's a very rugged kind of country here, a lot of hills and mountains. This is the same place where Ish-bosheth had gone for help. And David, as you know, worked with them, and this man became a friend. He also helped Mephibosheth. And so it was a very friendly place for Saul. And David was so kind to Saul's family, this man let David come. Look how far this old king, he went all the way from Jerusalem, had to go that far as a very old man fleeing from his son, Absalom. Now this territory, as I said, was pretty woolly. Josephus tells us that David had about 4,000 fighting men with him. So the army of Absalom was much larger, probably five times plus larger. But we're going to see what happens. And I think it's an interesting account. It's an extremely sad account in how this chapter is going to close. Then David numbered the people. Now, what we mean by that, he mustered them for battle. He organized them for war. He's going to divide them into threes. Now, he put them under several commanders. He put them under Joab, who was the strong man behind David's throne. And this was one expert military strategist. Now, he was a cruel man. When he decided to act, he acted. But he was loyal to David. And boy, he was an excellent military man. Now, the second man, this Abishai, was his brother. Now, there was a third one, but remember how Abner killed the third boy at the Battle of Gilboa much, much earlier in our study? Now, there's another man here. By the way, they're both related to David. Their mother was David's sister. Okay? Now, then it says, and one-third under the command of Ittai, the Gittite. Now, obviously, there was foreign troops with David. David always had the ability to rally foreign troops to himself. In his early days, when his flight from Saul, he had many foreign elements, mercenaries in his group. And when he fled, people began to come with him. And I think David realized there'd be some problem under these foreigners being commanded by Joab. So he let a foreigner command one-third of this army. Now, the reason they're going to break them up, and David and Joab, I'm sure, conspired on this, they were really sharp men, sharp strategists. Absalom had a much bigger army. But the territory is so rough that the army would have to be spread out to get there and have to do a forced march. Well, they're going to attack them in the midst of a very rugged terrain and dense forest. They're going to attack this larger army all spread out. And they are going to thoroughly rout them. Thoroughly rout them. And that's the strategy. Now, in the end of verse 2, it says that the king said, the people, I myself will surely go out with you also. This was common for the king to be at the battle. He was the commander-in-chief. He could stand on a hill and watch it. But David was so old. And they're going to say to him, look, David, if the army loses, we got hope of fighting again. David, if you lose, it's all over for all of us. David, stay here in the city. Now, he's not in Jerusalem. He's in this city. And I have a hard time pronouncing this thing. I'll just spell it for you. M-A-H-A-N-A-I-M. Okay, we think it's on the border of Gad and Manasseh on the eastern side of the Jordan, but we're not 100% sure. Now, the king said to them, whatever seems best to you, I will do. And that's unusual. I don't think David wanted to go out and fight anyway. So the king stood beside the gate, and all the people went out by hundreds and thousands. This hundreds and thousands is a very common way of dividing up military groups. The Romans used hundreds, centurions, and on. So did the Hebrews, okay? So David stood by the gate and kind of blessed them. It's kind of like a military review as they went out the gate. Now, the gate, of course, is the place of that was mostly fortified, had several rooms, sometimes double gates, and that's where David stood. And the king charged Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. Isn't that funny? David didn't say, victory, Godspeed, have a good fight. He said, please, please, please don't kill Absalom. I think David's own guilt is beginning to rise in his throat. Okay, the people went out into the field against Israel, and the battle took place in the forest of Ephraim. Now, as you know, Ephraim is on the western side of Jordan. But this whole context seems to imply that we're on the eastern side of Jordan, and that we're somehow the ascent out of the Jordan Rift Valley. Now, apparently it was very wooded, very thick and brambly. That's why lions used to live in this Jordan Rift Valley. It's a very dense undergrowth. And that's apparently where the battle took place, on the eastern side of the Jordan, though there is some debate over that. And the people of Israel were defeated there before the servants of David. Notice the constant distinction between the children of Israel and David's servants. It almost seems like that Absalom somehow was able to pick on this rivalry between the house of Saul and the house of David. Somehow he was able to exploit that, because most of Israel was with Absalom. A very handsome, very tall, very popular man. Now, then it mentions... Let's see. And the people of Israel were defeated there before the servants of David, and the slaughter there that day was about 20,000 men. Now remember, Josephus says David had about 4,000. We don't know. Boy, 20,000 people dying, that's quite a lot of men. And we learn from the context that Joab stopped the fight and let many of them get away. So there's a large, large military contingent, but they weren't professional trained soldiers. It'd be like sending out a bunch of... ROTC boys, a lot of them, thousands of them, against a small company of Green Berets. The numbers were more, but the experience and the tactics and the surprise were all on the side of David's men. The terrain is on the side of David's men. Surprise on the side of David's men. And it's going to prove to be the effective one. Now, for the battle there was spread over the whole countryside. The forest devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. Now, two lines of interpretation here. One, more literal, says that the forest was a gorges and potholes and marshes, and a lot of men died by falling off cliffs and falling into quicksand and all kinds of things like that. The forest literally killed them. Others say, no, what we have here is that when the battle began to go badly, these farmers who had just volunteered to try to help Absalom for a few weeks became discouraged and afraid and fled through the forest going back home. Well, I don't know which happened, but you can see that the terrain was greatly in David's favor. Now, Absalom happened to meet the servants of David. And the reason I think it happened is, I think probably what may have happened is that Absalom was riding his royal mule. Now, that sounds funny to us, but the mule was a sign of royalty, wealth. It was possibly David's own mule, because that had been another sign of his kingship. And he apparently was leading the army, and they were strung out for a long distance, going up this heavy terrain to try to meet David the next day around this city. I'm sure Absalom never expected David to try to this surprise attack. Because you don't expect a king to be out in the front by himself with no bodyguard. And you really don't expect him to be riding a mule in the middle of battle. You just don't expect that. So apparently either Absalom saw part of this, one of these three groups, or Absalom got cut off some way, and here he was on his mule, and he went under the thick branches of a great oak. Well, it's a tenebith tree. It has large branches. And the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak. Now, it's only Josephus that tells us that his hair got caught. Now, back in chapter 14:27, we know that Absalom cut his hair only once a year. Now, there are probably several reasons for that. One is that long hair was a sign of commitment to God, and many of the soldiers never cut their hair but went into battle with long hair. And the reason for that is the Nazarite vow of number 6. So Absalom cut his hair once a year, but it was long and black, and he was such a handsome man. Now, it may be not his hair, because that's just assumed. It says his head got caught. Maybe he was a tall man, and I'm sure he was very high on that mule. And maybe his neck got caught. I'm sure he was in such a hurry to get away that in all the confusion, he probably looked around to see where David's men were and ran right into that branch. And it, either a fork in his head got stuck or his hair got caught and he couldn't move. He's just suspended. The mule went right out from under him. And there he was just hanging in that tree. I'm sure he tried to get himself free, but either he was stunned by the branch hitting him in the head, or he was immobilized by the way he was trapped. And there he was. Now, let's see where I am. Okay, verse 10. Then a certain man saw it and told Joab and said, "Behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak, Tenabeth." And Joab said to the man who told him, "Now behold, you saw him? Why did you not strike him there to the ground? I would have given you 10 shekels of silver and a belt." This belt's a fancy girdle that held all the pieces of war in place, a real honorable thing. And the man said, "Are you kidding me? I heard what David said on the gate. I wouldn't have done it for 50 times that amount of money. David would have killed me, sure. You may have killed me, but he said, I wouldn't have done that for nothing." Now, Joab says, "I ain't got time to talk to you, boy." And he's going to go on. Show me where it is. All right? Verse 13. "Otherwise, if I had dealt treacherously against his life, and there is nothing hidden from the king." That's in parentheses in my Bible. Boy, there were some people who told the king everything. There was a pretty good spy network, you know. And the CIA was alive and well in David's throne just as well today, I want you to know. "Then you yourself would have stood aloof." What he's saying is, "Yeah, Joab, I should have killed him. And when it came down to standing before David, you'd have suddenly disappeared. And I'd have been stuck with this act myself. You came by me for that." Then Joab said, "I'm not going to waste time with you." And he took 3 spears. Now, these are wooden spears. "And thrust him through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. And 10 young men who carried Joab's armor gathered around and struck Absalom to kill him." Now, here's what I think. It seems a contradiction. If you're jabbed through the heart with 3 spears, I don't know why you're not dead, right? What Joab did, Joab was the first to raise his hand against the king's son. And he stuck him in the middle part of his body with these spears. But Absalom wasn't dead. Apparently he was suffering. But once these very loyal servants of Joab saw that Joab had struck the king's son, they said, "We'll do it too, so Joab won't take the blame." And so they all 10 attacked him. I bet Absalom was a hacked up mess. But they killed him. Okay? Now notice what's going to happen to him. "Then Joab blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing Israel, and for Joab restrained the people." This was a hard military man, but boy, he loved the Israeli people. As soon as Absalom was dead, he knew the rebellion was crushed. And the army was just being routed and destroyed by this military guerrilla force. Joab blew the trumpet and said, "Stop the battle. Don't kill any more of them. Let them go home." It was a real act of mercy on Joab's part. Now, this idea about blowing the trumpet was used for several things in Israel. We're talking about a zophar, a ram's horn. They blew it for religious festivals, and they blew it for military commands. I think the New Testament about the trumpet of the Lord shall sound and time shall be no more, that famous song, or 1 Thessalonians 4:13 and following, the angel is going to blow the trumpet, is an idea of the use of the trumpet this way. I remember it's a goat's, a ram's horn. They took Absalom and cast him into a deep pit in the forest. Now, really, there's a definite article here in Hebrew, which means the pit. That may have been a very famous pit. I don't know. But they threw the hacked up body of Absalom in this pit and then threw a bunch of rocks on top of him for one of several reasons. Number one, maybe they were trying to make some monument to this dead king. Maybe. Maybe they were trying to show an act of contempt, like they did to Achan in Joshua 7. Let me find it. Joshua 7:26. Maybe they were trying to show that he deserved to die, and of course casting stones on someone was a symbol of judgment of God. Maybe that's what they were doing. I don't know what's happening, but here's the pit was filled up with rocks, and it was like an unmarked grave, unless that pit was a famous one, and everybody knew where it was. It seems they're in a deep forest, and nobody knows. Now, verse 18. "Now, Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up for himself a pillar." Now, the stones were a kind of pillar, probably of disgrace. "But Absalom set up a pillar for his namesake, which is in the king's valley." Now, from Genesis 14:17, it seems that this valley is near the city of Sodom. But Josephus tells us it's near the city of Jerusalem. We don't know which it is. For he said, I have no son to preserve my name. Now, if you'll read back in chapter 14:27, you'll see that he had three sons and a daughter. But it's highly unusual for the daughter to be named. Name is Tamar, after her daddy's sister who was raped by Ammon. It's highly unusual to name a daughter. The three sons aren't named, so probably the three sons died, and he recognized he'd have no more children. So he named the pillar after his own name, and it's called Absalom's Monument to this day. Now, they'll show you this in the modern Palestine, but I really don't think it's the same one at all. I think it's irony here, the two monuments. He put up one for his name to be remembered, but in reality, what's remembered is the place where he was ignominiously buried. Now, verse 19. We have here a scene where a message has to be taken back to David. The son of the high priest wants to take the message back, and Joab says, no. Now, we'll send this Cushite back. Now, a Cushite would be an Ethiopian, either a slave or a free man, we don't know. But anyway, he said, send a servant back. Well, the high priest's son kept bugging him, saying, let me go too. And finally, Joab said, well, all right, go. And so we pick up in verse 24, David sitting on top of the gate with the watchman. They're looking for something. Now, if a whole group of people would have been coming, they'd have said, oh, no, it's defeat. And here comes a retreating army. But if one man comes running, they think it's good news because only one means a messenger. A whole group would mean a retreat. So, in verse 25 it says, for he is by himself, there is good news in his mouth. That's probably what that means. Then the watchman saw another man running. For the son of Zadok took a shorter route than the Cushite did. So they're both coming. Verse 27 it says, he's running like the son of Zadok. And David says, good, he'll bring good news. It's almost like if it's an important man, it's good news. If it's a slave, you're not sure if it's good or bad. See, it's that kind of deal. Verse 28, the son comes and says, all is well. That's the word shalom. Shalom in Hebrew means the presence of good and the absence of evil. And they use it for a greeting and for a farewell. And he prostrated himself before the king, his face to the ground, and said, blessed is the Lord your God who has delivered up the men who lifted up their hands against the Lord the king. Now, this idea about who lifted up their hands, an interesting Hebrew word. It means to shut up the man. Now, not like we say it, but to mean to close him in tight where he has no room to move. You see, in Hebrew, the idea of being in a wide place is the metaphor for blessing. And you see that in two places in the Bible. You ought to look at 2 Samuel 22:20 and Psalms 31:8. And that'll show you this idea about being in a wide place. When God puts his feet on a wide place, a sign of blessing. And the king said, his answer wasn't, how did it happen? Thank God you're back safe. Boy, thank you for the victory. All the king thought of is, what about Absalom? Now, the high priest's son says, I don't know. So the other guy comes in. Cushite arrived. Let my lord the king receive good news. The Lord has freed you this day from the hand of those who rose against you. And the king said to the Cushite, is it well with the young man Absalom? And the Cushite answered, let the enemies of my lord the king and all who raise up against you for evil be as that young man. David knew he would die. And the king was deeply moved. Now, the Hebrew word here means he began to tremble. Have you ever seen somebody in anger or fear or just a grief begin to tremble? It was obvious. David didn't say, oh, thank God for victory. David began to mourn. He was emotionally distraught, and he went to this private chamber above the gate. This is what he said. And thus, as he walked, they could hear him talking up in this chamber. He was wailing out loud, grieving. Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, were to God I would have died for you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. Now, you can picture David doing that hour after hour. We learned the next chapter it got so bad that the victorious army returning felt like they had lost. And that David was happier, was more sorrow over his son dying than they were still alive and victorious. They could hear him wailing up over that gate, walking back and forth, howling, grieving, shrieking. Now, I think part of it is, I don't think David was shrieking so much for Absalom. I think David knew that that boy died, that tall, handsome son died because of David's previous sin. And this was a prophetic judgment on David's house. I think David was grieving for himself because he knew he was the cause of this. You know, I do a lot of funerals. I like doing funerals. I get a chance to proclaim the gospel to folks who'll never be in church at a time when they're thinking about eternity. I like to do funerals. It's always amazed me at the grief that's expressed at funerals. The people who grieve the most at funerals are the ones who have acted so ugly toward the person that's died in their lifetime. And now they're trying to make it up by grieving. Friends, you can't make up what you've done, not done or not done in life at the funeral. David was a terrible, terrible father, and his son paid the consequences. David needed to be a better father, not an active mourner. Friends, if you're going to give somebody some flowers, don't do it when they die. Send it to them now, man. Send it to them now. So if you look at 19, Joab comes in and says, "Look, King, you're acting the pits. Now these people are going to leave you and desert you, and you're going to be worse off than you were before if you don't get your act together and go stand on that wall and thank God for them that they're back safe. If they won the battle for you, they put their life on the line for you, and here you are acting like it's defeat. Now snap out of it, King." And David recognized that Joab really had a truth there. And if you'll read the rest of 19, you'll see what happens. Now, it's so important that during these lessons, you need to get the big picture, which means read the life of David completely. But at least read the couple of chapters moving into every lesson and a couple of chapters going out to every lesson, so you'll get the picture of what's happening. And it'll really make the lesson much better to those. Well, I've enjoyed being with you. I hope to see you same time, same place next week. God bless you.